to Mr. Penny first, or...?
Mr. Penny hasn't quite joined us, but the order isn't essential, so we could hear from Mr. O'Callaghan.
Do we have a supplementary with Mr.
Gallagher? His brief was so short and focused on just one point, we haven't had him prepare one.
Okay, let me just pull it up in that case. Ah, yes.
There it is.
Oh, yes, we're arguing over millimetres. Right.
500, yeah.
Okay.
Go to.
Mr. O'Callaghan, welcome.
Thank you.
You've got a panel of four commissioners here. Just quickly run down the panel.
Good afternoon, Nigel Markgraff.
Tēnā koe, Vicky Morrison Shaw.
Afternoon, Ewan Wilson.
And I'm David Hill, and off you go.
Thank you. Well, yes, as you've realised, my statement is fairly narrow. Yes. It relates to an appropriate width, no pun intended. It relates to an appropriate width for the services berms. In summary, a services berm needs to be wide enough to contain the services needed for an urbanised built environment. This is typically 1 to 1.5 metres. And this width is used all over the country. The services berm should not be excessively wide because that is a waste of land and results in an inefficient use of land, which is a valuable but limited and finite resource. Hence, the best outcome is to have a services berm just wide enough to meet the demands for the service authorities and maximise the remaining land for housing. The 1.5 metre width is proposed in table 15/6B. That's in appendix 15, the transport appendix to PC5, for all road types except a collector road, which is in the table defined as 2 metres. I consider the 1.5 metre width should apply to all road types, as there is no greater need in a collector road for a greater width. The services are essentially the same, they're no larger, and they don't need any additional width from one road type to another. And that's it, really.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Mr. Callaghan. Thank you for that. We've obviously got a high noon situation here between you and council.
Yes.
You're saying 1.5, they're saying 2, and I don't think there's any room for manoeuvre, is there? I mean, we don't have an option of 1.75, which...
That's right.
..which we might otherwise impose, but I guess we're just going to have to hear back from council on that on Monday and see whether there's any movement on that, but certainly understand your argument. I don't know if there's any other questions, are there? Not really. So thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Good.
All right. And that brings us to Mr. Penny.
Are you there, Mr. Penny?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. Were you here to hear the rundown as we just introduced the panel to the previous speaker?
No, I'm sorry, I wasn't.
Okay,
we'll hooked in at that stage.
We'll do it again in that case.
Good afternoon, Nigel.
Sorry.
Tēnā koe, Vicky Morrison Shaw.
Afternoon, Ewan Wilson.
And I'm David Hill, Mr. Penny. So we have your summary, so if you'd like to take us through your summary, we'd appreciate that.
Right, I have to refer to my phone because I've had a printer malfunction today. So in terms of my involvement, really the objective has been to come up with some rather detailed design criteria. That's been the main issue, to make things easier for developers and the council to come up with a good result in the easiest possible way, just to make sure both parties are on the same page. To a large extent, that's been achieved in other areas. For example, the 50 metre minimum accessway separation that was to be applied to collector roads as well as minor arterials. It now only applies to minor arterials, which is a lot more practical. And in terms of those design criteria, there have been criteria for three extra roads added to Table 15.6B. That's a minor arterial, which is not a new category in itself, but it wasn't in the original 6B version. And the version, the details in 6A are rather general. They mainly just say details to be decided. The open space edge is a new road, and the neighbourhood street. Largely, Mr. Black, for the council and myself have come to an agreement on a lot of matters, but we have fundamental differences over neighbourhood streets. As far as I'm concerned, the critical matter is the matter of having vehicles parked on the curbside rather than in recessed bays. In that way, vehicles' speeds are slowed and drivers' attentiveness are triggered by the presence of the curbside parking. And that requires drivers to manoeuvre around the parked cars and to give way to any vehicles travelling in the opposite direction. If recessed parking bays are provided, then the street would not be significantly different from the local road category. In terms of carriageway width for neighbourhood streets, I recommend two ranges, which is explained in my main evidence in chief. The dimensions for the carriageway widths indicated in Table 15.16B are not labelled as minimum desirable as most other dimensions are. Accordingly, there is an inference that the dimensions specified are absolute. I do not consider this is appropriate, nor would a minimum desirable dimension in the case of a neighbourhood street, and hence my suggested ranges. I'd just like to add, it's not noted there, that in support of his opinion, Mr. Black refers to a Waka Kotahi design guide. Now, that only, I don't find that very helpful in terms of neighbourhood streets, because it only contains one residential street type, and that is equivalent to a local road, not a neighbourhood street. And furthermore, the guide only has one dimension for that local road, and that is the legal street width. It doesn't specify the sort of details we're trying to get to here for carriageway width, service berms you've just been talking about, etc. And interestingly, it only specifies one dimension as a range. So for a legal street width, it specifies 14 to 20 metres. Returning to my summary points, in terms of the upper threshold of neighbourhood streets, this has got awfully complicated, and I think if we'd had more time, we had two sessions of expert conferencing, and one was additional, and we couldn't really fit in a third one, we might have come to some agreement over this, because normally you don't have threshold specified for when you use a particular type of road, etc. And we got to the point where we thought it would be a good idea. Then when it came, push came to shove, it's actually not so easy to specify. But the table is only a guidance. And so I had suggested two thresholds, 150 metres and 250 metres, for streets meeting the wider carriageway width range, with the lower of those thresholds applying to a cul-de-sac, and the higher threshold applying to a street with two ends, i.e. not a cul-de-sac, a road that you can get out either end. And the reason for that is because a road where you can get either end has a lower traffic density and fewer vehicle conflicts. In a cul-de-sac, everybody has to come out the one point. So at that point, there's quite a lot of, well, not a lot of traffic, but relatively it's more traffic than you would with a street with two ends. So if you're going to have a neighbourhood street that's got two ends, it could afford to be longer, which is the logic behind my two different thresholds. And then I forgot and omitted to put in footnote 10 of table 15.6B that we needed equivalent thresholds for the narrower carriageway width range. And I put in my evidence, I suggested that they might be 75 metres and 125 metres. rather simply half of the wider range.
Just before you go on, Mr. Penny, can I just ask why you expressed some confidence that if you could meet more, you'd close the gap between the two of you? There are a couple of days before Monday when Council replies to us. Is that an opportunity to close that gap?
Oh, I'd be happy to discuss it further with Mr. Black. We really just didn't get time because it was such a tight time frame through the conferencing and then on to evidence, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's noted by the fact that some of the things we agreed in conferencing didn't actually get into the Section 42 report. But absolutely happy to have further discussions with Mr. Black if he sees any benefit in that.
All right. Is that a conversation that you would therefore have to have with Mr. McKenzie as well?
No. That's on a different matter, which I'll come to in my summary shortly.
Right. Well, I leave that to Council to decide whether or not there's merit in that. Thank you. All right. You're on your paragraph 9.
And now on to 10. There are also some other changes that I suggested that Mr. Black does not agree with, in particular the carriageway was specified for local roads and collector roads. I adopted the New Zealand Standard 4404 of 5.6 for local roads and applied increases to 6 for a collector road with public transport and to 6.4 for collector roads with public transport. First I should have said without and then with.
Sorry, Tony, I've just had a brief chat with Mr. Muldoney, and we concur that there are a lot of matters here that can probably be discussed between the experts.
That would be good, because we're not going to be able to do much without some to-ing and fro-ing on.
No, you're not.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So does that? Should we let Mr. Penny finish, or is he? Is that it, basically?
Well,
do you want to have a conversation with a sidebar with Mr. Penny?
Yeah, I think, can Mr. Penny, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Do you consider that the issues with Mr. McKenzie can be reconciled by conferencing as well? And when I say conferencing, let me preface that by a discussion where you produce just an agreed statement for the panel.
I'm less confident, to be honest, about that. As I'll come to in my summary, one part of that is comments on details of design for the local centre. And to a certain extent, I agree, as I say, with Mr. McKenzie's comments on that, but I see solutions to it. And so when the time comes to do the design for the local centre, for consenting, etc., I'm sure we can address those issues.
Well, are those consenting issues as opposed to planning issues?
I think they are, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then I suggest you have a discussion, that we just set aside a discussion between you and Mr. McKenzie and you and the other... Mr. Buckham, and we see where you can get to.
Yeah.
Yes. Happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Penny. Appreciate your time and all the best with respect to conversations.
Right. Thank you.
So it just remains with Mr. Collins, I think. Yes.
Thank you. it's easier than you can copy. I just have a question anyway.
Good afternoon.
And good afternoon, Mr. Collins. I hope you're not going to take us through every condition.
No, no.
The provision of the plan change. Yes.
Not at all. Not
excellent.
At all.
Thank heavens.
So, yeah, look, I provided the evidence in chief and evidence in reply, which I believe you've read. So this summary I've put before you, I mean, I had a two-page exec summary in my evidence in chief, which, given the breadth of summary, well, submission points, it's hard to summarise much below that. So what I thought might be the most useful of time would be to talk through the main points in attachment one to my evidence in chief, which are my suggested amendments, and you may have noticed I've numbered each change, so hopefully that'll be good for ease of reference when we get there. We can just go to number 30 or go to number whatever.
Yeah, thank you.
In terms of ecology and long-tail bat habitat protection, after explaining the key elements of the peacock structure plan in paragraphs 27 to 35 of my evidence, I note in paragraph 36 that 143 hectares of natural open space zone represents either 17 or 19% of the peacock structure plan area. I won't go into the reason why it's one or the other. It depends on the total area. There's a discrepancy there.
Yeah.
But it's a significant proportion, is my point, 17 to 19%. And the significant bat habitat areas provide enhancement opportunities to create new and additional bat corridors, linkages, and habitat. In paragraph 44 of my evidence in chief, I note my support for the Section 42A report's proposed new objective and policy that recognise the role that peacock's network of open space and new significant bat habitat areas have in mitigating the adverse effects of existing urbanisation as well as future development on the habitat of long-tailed bats. In paragraph 50 of my evidence in chief, I comment, and this is probably where we start to diverge, I comment on Council's frequent reference to a landscape-scale approach to bat management and the desirability of a strategic, coordinated and centralised approach, but its seeming reluctance to include provisions that commit Council to action and its reliance instead on landowners within Peacock to fill the void and take on enhancement planting, bat monitoring, pest control, and reporting commitments. And you'll see all of those, for example, in the bat management plan provisions in section 1.2.2.28.
Yeah.
And I just feel that's going to be ad hoc, expensive, duplicated effort, unconnected as opposed to what could be with a more coordinated approach led by council. Maybe before I whip to some of those changes on ecology, I could just turn to a couple of pages in the rebuttal, just to bring it to your attention. So this is in relation to Mr. Gooding for Director General of Conservation. I was just really, in my 33, I just bring together a lot of the Waikato Regional Policy Statement objectives, policies and methods that are going to be relevant for you, and I attach those in full as an attachment. And over in 35, I refer specifically to method 11.1.3 of the Waikato Regional Policy Statement, which relates to the non-significant vegetation and non-significant habitats. It's an earlier method that deals with the SNAs. But what this method talks about is the promotion of biodiversity offsets as a means to achieve no net loss where, and I've just bolded for emphasis, significant residual adverse effects are unable to be avoided, remedied or mitigated. I just wanted to point that out because I think in some of the conversation I'm left with the impression that every last little residual effect ought to be offset, and I just wanted to point to that method there in the RPS. Moving on, if I may, also in rebuttal to paragraph 39 and 40, Mr. Gooding, he makes quite a point about chapter 20, which is the citywide chapter on significant natural areas, and the avoid policies. And I just feel he's misconstrued the intent of those, because it's very clear very first sentence, I'm reading from paragraph 39 now of my rebuttal, but the very first sentence in chapter 20 states that the purpose of the chapter relates to the significant natural areas and those other scheduled items. And then there's a table therein which is headed significant natural areas. And it's clear to me that all of the policies that are there, they're there to achieve objective 20.2.1, which is that significant natural areas are protected, maintained, restored, enhanced. So the various avoid policies, and he concludes by saying there's a disconnect. I'm in paragraph 40 of my rebuttal. He talks about a disconnect between his perceived avoidance directive of the ADP and this way the effects management has happened in PC5, and I just submit there's no disconnect at all. Chapter 20 is focused on the SNAs, and yes, avoidance of effects is more appropriate there. Just moving on to 43 of my rebuttal, where Mr. Gooding talks about this matter of the minimum width of the SBHAs, and he talks about the vision and strategy and Section C matters, valid qualifying matters, and I agree with that, and I feel it's been used in PC5 to vary things like setback distances and so on, but I do fail to see the connection then between that accepting of that those qualifying matters exist and Mr. Gooding's proposed 100 metre minimum width. So I guess I prefer the evidence that I've heard today from Mr. Blaney and indeed council's ecologists there. So just note that. I think on this point, what I might try and do is start referring to some of the specific changes that I would think are relevant in terms of ecology and bats. So if you just go to my summary, I'm on clause 9, and you'll see I refer to a number of specific changes. So now I'm going to control the mouse here. I'm not sure if I can scroll down with this. Oh yes, that got me to that one. Keep page down and page up, I'll try. So I talk about this...
I don't think anyone can read that. Borrowing someone else's glasses isn't going to make a difference there.
It's too small for you?
I've got it in front of my screen.
Okay, well, that's fine. I was just concerned about you having to scroll back and forth between the evidence in chief and the attachment, but that's fine. In my paragraphs 45, I guess, through to about 50, I talk about PC5 have accepted, by way of an advisory note, of all of these positive functions that a bat and habitat enhancement panel can fulfil. And I list those out in paragraph 47, clauses A to H. I express a preference for the Director General's wording for such a panel, which deletes the word review, which implies the more proactive approach. And I guess I'm sort of concluding whether an advisory note is sufficient or whether it should be referenced in new policy, because I really think this panel will provide a really important role in the implementation of Plan Change 5's intent. So I've recommended a wording of a policy that I believe could slip into Chapter 3A. It's in my paragraph 49, and it's number 3 there on the screen. I think as an addition, but I guess if you weren't wedded to that or not convinced that it was necessary, then certainly in section 1.5.4 of the district plan is that part of the district plan that sets out a lot of non-regulatory methods. And so section 1.5.4 hasn't been amended by Plan Change 5 yet, but I think there's certainly scope in submissions to put a method in there to refer to this. I just think an advisory note is really undermining the important role of this. That's a panel that's referred to at length in all of the sort of, well, ecologist and planning briefs of evidence. So that set out my change number 3 is the policy, and change 57 in attachment 1. Picking up on some of the points that Dr. Flynn and others have made today, in my paragraph 54 of my evidence in chief, I just noted that council need not, and in my view should not, necessarily wait for subdivision processes to accept the significant bat habitat areas as reserves. That can be one mechanism, sure, but I think if there was sole reliance on that, it's likely to result in a piecemeal approach and rather a long time frame for the creation of these significant bat habitat areas and enhancement of habitats. So I understand from Council's Section 42A report there has been some funding set aside and for that reserve acquisition process to start. I think the 42 report talks about the potential advantages of a more proactive acquisition and enhancement strategy, but then it states that it doesn't intend to use designations or Public Works Act processes. But I still think there's room for willing buyer-seller transactions, augmented, if need be, by Public Works Act, but to achieve the significant bat habitat areas, if council does want to get ahead of the game and rather than do the piecemeal SBHAs on subdivision vesting. I think I might go now to number 41 of the, this is the low to moderate vegetation issue. So I talk about this, it's a reasonable chunk of my evidence because I think it's quite important, all the way from paragraphs 58 through to paragraphs 70. I do believe that having set aside all of these significant areas of significant natural area and then the buffer areas in terms of SBHAs, and we remember that figure of 17 to 19% of the overall area, so a significant effort's been put into that protection regime, and I think the trade-off when you're trying to achieve multiple objectives like Plan Change 5 is that you then need to enable the development fairly efficiently within that residual area that's set aside for the medium density housing in the local centre and so on. And I just feel like at present the rules are set up in such a way that it's just going to be a real slog, real inefficient, and I'll come to the details to back up that point. But the Section 42A report does propose a standard 25.2.5.2 which addresses this issue of low to moderate vegetation in the Peacock structure plan area. I've set that out in paragraph 64 of my evidence in chief. I do understand from the ecologist there's a clause there which talks about whether the tree is an existing bat roost tree. That's reasonably clear, I understand. But that whether there's low potential for a tree to be used as habitat for long-tailed bats, I understand that is going to capture a lot of that vegetation above the 1.4 metres 15, sorry, the actual diameter of breast height is 150 mils at 1.4. But that, you know, there's a lot of trees are going to be caught by that. What I've suggested in this rule is not substantially different. So down to the next page there. I've just turned it around as it is a permitted activity rule, trying to express it as, you know, what is allowed and less rather than what isn't allowed. The key thing here, it's still going to capture quite a few trees with that same measurement. I've not amended clause one there at all. And the proposal there in clause two A and B is that there still be this ability for a suitably qualified bat ecologist to basically assess the tree, and if it's only if it's not a confirmed or potential bat roost tree would it be the permitted activity route. Otherwise it's going to be an RDA with a companion rule that I'll come to. So there's nothing substantially different about that one. Where I provide some differences is where a consent's required, I'm really hoping to streamline in an appropriate way the information requirements and management plans and so on that all of these separate landowners are going to be obliged to do. So let me get to that now, which would probably be my change 51, I would say. Okay, now you'll see here, could I first just take you to my paragraph 73 and 74 of my evidence in chief. And of course we're notified these bat management plans were just applying in within the SBHA areas. It's they've taken on a new lease of life with this proposed new standard that's going to, and the proposal now from council is that all the landowners and developers that are needing to remove this vegetation within the outside the SBHA areas are also going to have to provide this information as per the Section 42A report. And you'll see in my paragraph 74, I've just itemised what they would require in terms of that section 1228. Not only do they identify trees, there's methodology, pre and post development monitoring, detailed pre-felling monitoring regime, avoidance remediation offsetting mitigation measures, paraphrasing initiatives that link to other areas, summary of planned works regarding replacement, biosecurity protocols, etc. There's ongoing monitoring obligations for the consent holder, obligations to report to the Bat and Habitat Review Panel. There's pest control measures for cats and mustelids. There's proposals for installation and maintenance of artificial bat roots, roost boxes, and perhaps I can take the rest as read, but it goes on, obviously vesting proposals, off-site compensation and so on. And then also inviting each applicant really to come up with their own financial contribution proposals as a means to offset mitigation, albeit with the guide of the Tonkin and Taylor report. Now, in my opinion, the list of requirements for bat management plans is just too wide-ranging and onerous. Certainly outside the SNA and SBHA areas, I consider the time and expense and effort and I've used the word unlikely consternation that these requirements would place on landowners and developers as they each have to individually address all those requirements. And see, the issue for the wider peacock area is there's just being a truckload of investment, millions and millions in infrastructure that's got to be recouped through contributions. Development has to happen in a timely manner, and I really feel that it's quite essential that the Peacock Structure Plan area does get developed in a timely manner and to the densities envisaged so that development can repay those investments through development contributions and again in a timely manner. And of course there's all those housing outcomes as well, and I just feel that Those information requirements are over the top, and I've suggested here a different approach. What I'm suggesting is that they don't each have to prepare a BAT management plan, but rather anything that requires a consent. Remember that rule 25.2 standard I talked about just before, where the ecologist says that it's got potential or it is a confirmed bat roost, it automatically triggers to an RDA and this requirement for information. So for vegetation clearance and subdivision in those circumstances, they've got to provide an ecological assessment prepared by a suitably qualified bat ecologist, and that assessment...
Yeah, I don't think you need to take
it. I don't need to do it, right? But it's comprehensive. It's no easy route.
I think it's just in terms of efficiency of time, if you just articulate the difference, which you've just done in terms of this is what you're proposing, is it takes out what you think the council should do and leaves what the landowner is required to do, and that's fine. The detail we'll work through.
Okay. Well, that's fine. So I'll just leave you with it. It's a fairly comprehensive ecological assessment required, and it does just as you say, sir. So that's one, and with that you can see pages and pages of sort of strikeout text for the stuff that wouldn't then be necessary. Yep. With that, I guess, in 52 and 54, which becomes some amended, that's all the strikeout, because it would otherwise be required of owners. I've just noted that reference to the panel. Then you've got some amended assessment criteria, which I think I can probably take as read. It's referred to in paragraphs 164 to 167 on my evidence. And I'm happy just to take those as read. Paragraph 30, there's some rules in there, I think, and my change 32, so I'm back up, sorry, was just agreed in caucusing, somehow slipped the net in the 42A report, I'm sure just in the rush of getting it out, but there was all agreed, for example, though, within significant natural areas, that there'd be a consenting pathway for appropriate things like walking ways and back furniture and so on, so I commend that change to the panel.
Okay.
The lighting and glare standard, I will just put that to you, 42. This is one where Adair didn't have a lighting evidence. It's a shame that I've followed Mr. McKenzie here, but the point being made here in clause C, well, firstly, sorry, we just amended it to apply to the whole precinct because it's the lighting could happen in a local centre as well, not just the medium density zone. Yeah. But the key issues in clause C, you could potentially get some quite large super lot sites being set aside or balanced land set aside adjacent to these SPHAs. But the more onerous lighting standards that are recommended here by Mr. McKenzie, and I believe largely endorsed by Ms. Mander, they're really raising the bar on lighting standards, and I think there's an issue of, bear in mind the bat habitat area itself provides a 20 metre buffer before you get to the SNAs, that then there is a question, the adjacent land could be 100 metres, could be 200 metres away from the boundary. I just think it would be good if you could inquire as to what an appropriate distance of the SPHA that those standards might apply. And I say that just in the interest of, appropriate section 32, making sure the conditions standards are reasonable. And then finally, I will just like to point, what you have seen in my evidence, that a deer accepts the minimum 50 metres. Therefore, you might wonder why at the top of the screen there, which is, sorry, now the bottom of the screen, number 40, you might wonder why I've crossed out in the subdivision rule, maintain the minimum width of 50. And the reason for that is these corridors frequently follow property boundaries, and you're going to have a situation where one subdivider on one side of the boundary, if you like, has to divest its 25 metres, say, and then the other one will. Another good reason why some proactive purchasing in advance might be better than waiting for them both to come together through vesting, but that's another point. The thing is, it won't be, the individual people won't always have to do 50 metres, but it's being zoned for it, so there is no doubt 50 metres will be the minimum, and I think that's appropriate.
So where is the requirement for the aggregate to be 50 metres? Where have you put that?
Well, actually haven't, because the thing is, they're all zoned natural open space, and it's all delineated right. in the district okay. plan. So you can only subdivide your medium density residential land, not for housing purposes, if you like, any of the natural open space zone. So you recall the discussion between overlay versus zoning for the natural open space? Well, one of the advantages is the certainty that what's shown on the structure plan as SNA and the SPHAs will be delivered, because that's the zoned, that's the zoning underneath. And they are a minimum of 50 metres, if you know what I mean. So,
okay. Just need to think that one through, because it's not a 50 metres absolute. It's a negotiable.
It's a minimum. What's shown there are the minimums of 50. Yeah. They do widen out in places, and I think all the ecology experts think that's appropriate as well. It's not...
Right. Okay.
So it's just, the reason it's changed there, though, if I've made that point, it's just any one landowner where they go along the boundary.
Understood where you're going. I just want to be sure that in actual fact that the required minimum is captured accurately somewhere on the maps or somewhere like that. Because what you're doing, well, I think what you've probably done there, but you've put attention back onto the accuracy of the maps. And that's, I guess that's a question. All right.
Yes, I have. Turning now, that's it for ecology, turning on to I think that's fine for ecology for now. Although in my rebuttal on paragraph 46, I guess push back on the concept of replicating all of the offsetting principles and all of the compensation principles that Mr. Gooding has proposed would be inserted into PC5.
Yeah.
Not least because the Indigenous biodiversity is not even gazetted yet, but also where do you stop? Once it is gazetted, you've got to give effect to it.
Absolutely.
So pushing back on that one. Turning to residential density and the residential standards. Oh, look, I support the Section 42A report in this regard, the proposed rewording of Policy 8, which was evolved through the conferencing process. So I fully support that. I deal with it as my evidence in chief between paragraphs 87 and 100. And you'll see if you read those that I've placed some emphasis on the kind of master planning work that Mr. Bredemeyer and the engineers and the planners and others have done for the West Block, because they've really tried to do a realistic representation, not just for their holdings, but of the kind of land that applies throughout the Peacock area. And I think they've done a good job of that. So,
nothing like patting yourself on the back.
Well, no, I wasn't involved. But I wasn't involved, to be fair. I had no involvement. But, but I think in the 97, I mean, paragraph 97, I do kind of get Kaingora's desire to set stretch targets, if you like. But I believe that when you're setting a policy, and that policy expresses a minimum overall net density, that there's a need to take a realistic approach as opposed to too much of an aspirational approach. I think there is a need to have regard to the practical constraints and nature of the topography in this area. And I believe that this policy 8 that talks about the 30 and then the 45 and the increased area, you know, that is raising the bar considerably on what Hamilton has been achieving in the past. It is. And it's enabling above that as well. So I believe that's appropriate. I think I can leave the rest of that section there taken as read. Turning to the local and neighbourhood centres, I'm in my summary, just clause 13. I do support the current location and extent of the local centre zone east of Peacock Road, as I've discussed in paragraph 129 through to 135 of my evidence in chief, and also paragraphs 47 to 55 of my reply. Happy to take any questions on that, but I mean, obviously I do draw upon the expert evidence of the urban designers for both the DAIR and council, and the retail economists for both parties as well there in reaching my conclusions. But it seems like there is ample zoned capacity to meet projected demand for commercial floor space and plus. And I believe that the urban design outcomes, as outlined by Mr. Bredemere, makes sense for it to be on or distributed on the east side of Peacock Road. There's a couple of changes in terms of those gross floor area caps. If I go to number 23, this is building on Mr. Bowker's evidence. You'll see there's that rule 45 in the neighbourhood centre zone where I've suggested adding in the extra activities. There, into the cap, and in paragraphs 40 to 142 of my evidence in chief, I've just noted that retail caps of this nature are not new for Hamilton City Plan, and I refer to examples sort of in a sub-regional sense, the base, but I refer to the Ruakura Retail Centre as another example, more of the right scale here. And for example, in that floor space cap that applies there, they do apply to all permitted activities. So I sort of feel like these caps are a good idea. I do support them, and I feel that those activities should come within them. Just draw your attention, if I may, to paragraph 142 of my evidence in chief, which also, we're talking about chapter 6, those business zones, outside Plan Change 5, but it's all about the existing retail hierarchy, and it's the explanation sentence there that I've bolded a phrase there which talks about suburban centres varying in size and character between 10,000 and 20,000 square metre gross floor area. So, you know, this 20,000 square metre gross floor area cap that we're talking about has some basis in Hamilton's existing suburban and retail hierarchy there.
That's helpful noting that, thank you.
Yeah.
Could I just ask a quick question on H, officers? Could you give me a better description of what you're actually articulating there?
If you can give me a moment, I remember writing it not so long ago in my reply to Ms. Tate of Kāinga Ora, where I actually agreed with her suggestion about provision for officers. There's information overload here. In paragraphs 6 through to... paragraph 6, really, reply evidence. Start 5 and 6, if I may. Ms. Tate has sort of promoted permitted activity status for officers, both commercial and professional, and I just noted that... DAIR would support that in its submission, and myself as a planner, I support it also. The district plan has a definition of office, and it refers to, you know, administrative offices, commercial offices, professional offices, and in Plan Change 5, they're limited to less than 250 square metres gross floor area. At present, they're discretionary activities, and I think the discussion I would agree with is that there's room for them to become permitted activities because they are subject to their gross floor area standard, and any larger office would then become discretionary.
So just for clarity, you're not suggesting up to 800 square metres, but limited to the 250?
I'm suggesting that within the overall 800 square metre gross floor area within the neighbourhood centre, that cumulative total, then when you add up the retail, the offices, restaurants, whatever, together they should be within that 800 square metre cap, because when you multiply that out by the eight neighbourhood centres and so on.
Thank you.
Which gets me just down to the last little rats and mice of what I call other matters, but they're not such rats and mice, I guess, in change two. Sorry, these are in order of the plan, that's why I'm jumping around a bit. But in chapter three, there's some text, that strikeout text, there's some text that was added in by section 42A report, referring to master plans and design guides. I discussed that a bit in my paragraphs 113 and so on through. I sort of felt there was a really odd text to add in, because in fact plan change, well, firstly, there's only one design guide that is relevant, and that's the local centre design guide, and that is a statutory design guide in the sense that it's referred to in the assessment criteria, and there's various provisions that refer to it. So the reference down the bottom there about it being a non-statutory, it isn't factually correct, and I wouldn't support it being outside of the plan, where it could just be amended as need be, or as any person may wish, without the scrutiny of the landowner or the community. So I think it's rightfully a statutory design guide at the moment. It's alongside eight or nine others in the plan, so it's no anomaly. It's quite appropriate there. And then the other point there, it talks about, in the first sentence, to guide development in the Peacock Precinct, a master plan will need to be developed for either land use or subdivision. And I think this is a point of difference between myself and Ms. Tate. There's already a subdivision concept plan requirement for subdivisions, 10 lots or more. I think I talk about how that's got to demonstrate accordance with the structure plan, the relevant objectives and policies. That's there already. And the PC5 removes any other references to master plan, so I just think it's all a bit of an anomaly, that whole paragraph. It wasn't there when it was notified, it was only put in by the Section 42A report in response to Kiangora, and I think it should come out again.
Are you saying it's redundant, or it does something which you don't want to see? Not quite clear.
I'm saying it's redundant.
That's what I thought. That's just a yes, that's fine.
It's redundant and factually incorrect with PC5. Mm. Okay. And then if I could go to the landscape concept plan, it's my 48. And I should have introduced the colour coding. You'll already be familiar that red's the original plan change 5, green is the 64.
That's all right, colour blind anyway.
I made that really hard for you, sorry. But we're only the purple is what I'm recommending. And I've talked about in that in paragraphs 156 and 157 of my report. And the effect of these amendments is that those concept plans would only then apply where there's new public road or reserve areas proposed. And I felt that was appropriate to avoid capturing those applications for the re-subdivision of superlots. There's going to be a lot of this going on in Peacock. The road structure gets set, superlots are set aside, and then there's going to be this re-subdivision process. Now, they themselves don't contain reserves or future open or roads other than maybe privately owned rear lanes. These landscape concept plans, all of the requirements apply to the public realm element. So those changes there just make sure that you don't have to go preparing big landscape concept plans for public areas that where it's not relevant for your subdivision application. Last change on that I wanted to discuss was the ecological rehabilitation and management plan. requirement, which is this, just about, I'll click over the page, section 1.2.26. And I discussed that there. And again, rather than putting it on individual landowners and applicants for all of the subdivision applications, got no issue by removing that in that third line, the suggestion of the section 42A report to lower the threshold from 2 hectares to 5,000. That in itself is fine. But what I'm proposing there is that it's where an ecological assessment confirms the presence of a watercourse, a wetland, or significant indigenous vegetation, or significant habitat of fauna. When your ecological assessment does that, then you trigger the need for a full, ecological rehabilitation and management plan. You don't put pages and pages of information. I'll go to the page to show you what follows. All of these aspects, you don't need all those for all subdivisions over 5,000. Many of those will be well away and won't contain any of those features. So that's the purpose of the purple, purple font, but the other track changes I'm suggesting there. And then finally down in clause 7, I'm just striking out that fixed lighting design thing because, again, at a subdivision consent stage, you don't have all the building details of houses and other buildings, such thing. There is a city-wide, in fact, it's been discussed today with Mr. McKenzie, right? There's a chapter 25.6 lighting standard that applies. It sets out all the requirements. You don't need a management plan to tell you what you need to comply with. Especially as at subdivision stage, you just won't know those details of location anyway. So it's just not appropriate there. It's appropriate later. So I think that I guess what I've tried to do in my paragraph 17, last statement of my summary, I've tried to take a holistic approach, and I've tried to bear in mind the many different objectives that Plan Change 5 is trying to achieve. I've not sort of approached it from any one objective or the other. Tried to take a holistic approach and trying in those amendments to strike that right balance to achieve those objectives, but doing it in a way that's going to allow for that efficient, well, both development but also protection as per the structure plan. So happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Collins, and very helpful, certainly very detailed and very helpful. Whether we buy it or not, it's very helpful. Just a general question of you. In terms of the Bat Habitat Enhancement Plan, do you have any recommendations as to what that should look like? Or do you see any need for the plan to actually go further detail in terms of providing, say, some minimum skills that are required by that panel or anything like that?
I think I'd go to... I think you'd look at the functions there, or you can look at it on your screen. I've suggested it's establishing it in conjunction with the Regional Council, Mana Whenua, and Department of Conservation, with representatives.
Right.
But also with it looking at its role, sort of both proactively looking at the enhancement initiatives and directing the use of financial contributions in the most appropriate areas. So I think you'd look at the role of the panel and then try and draw representatives with the skills that match.
Right, and you don't see that the need, plan can't enable that, I know, but you don't see the need for that panel to have more than coordination and advisory function.
Proactive. Yeah, I do see.
I mean, obviously, if the councils are on that, they have a regulatory function in any event.
That there, separately, yes, I see it as more. It's planning and implementing the strategy. I mean, I rather liked how Dr. Flynn put it today in the sense that you know, you look at what it costs to acquire these SBHAs as per the structure plan. You do your research as to what it's going to cost to enhance. She suggested you then just do a divisor between the, you know, based on the area of the land ownership. I'd probably suggest there are other funding tools as well. So you might say, well, 50% of it's actually the citywide mitigation. There may be a general rate, or there may be other funding mechanisms, and then only another 50% done by the landowners through financial contributions. Whatever that ends up looking at, I do see that the review panel would be able to have input into, sorry, not review panel, I'm using the word that I myself have said we wouldn't use. It's a more proactive bat and habitat enhancement panel to look at which of the priorities, which of the, you know, and also looking outside the peacock area, because it's been very clear from the ecological evidence I've heard that there's opportunities outside the peacock area as well. So it would be a bit of a strategy and advisory thing, more so than any regulatory sense, in my view.
Okay. All right.
Have you had experience with the AMA field in terms of the consenting and all the bat management aspects?
Right, I haven't. So I said in my opening thing, I've got involved with this since about May this year.
Okay.
Yeah. I had a project director overview of our surveying and engineering role, but not, I wasn't involved in the planning.
But are you familiar with the Peacock area, like the topography?
Yeah. Oh, yes, yeah, very familiar.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, that's all I have. Thanks.
You took our planner, our case planner. No disrespect, Andrew.
Just a question in relation to that, which you've just put up there. I think today we heard a lot of the ecological witnesses talking about the importance of an interagency approach and that sort of thing. And I think we heard that Waipa and Waikato should also be part of the panel. Mm. At the moment, your drafting doesn't include them as panel members. It refers to them as responsible for directing use of financial contributions potentially in areas outside Peacock. Would you see it as being useful to enable them as being panel members as well?
Oh, look, if it's got a wider frame, I do think it's appropriate. To be honest, I had thought that reference to a citywide panel would sort of, I suppose, put the lead role on council, not the sole role, I should add, but the lead role in terms of then coordinating those other appointees. So I think it would be appropriate.
Mr. Collins, thank you very much. We appreciate that. And we'll hear a little bit more back on next Monday in terms of whether any of those ideas have been found comfort with the Section 42A authors. Yeah.
Thank you.
Right, which of you two is going to say that's it?
That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Well, no, thank you for expediting your witnesses. I mean, that's really helpful for us, obviously. The days tend to be long. Yes, that helps.
Thank you.
Now, are there any wash-up matters that we need to attend to?
Only to update you on the site visit. We've constructed a list of spots, stopping spots and things that we think will be of interest to you. That has been circulated to learned friends, also to Council for Woolworths and also DOC. I'm not quite sure whether there's any requirement to circulate it any wider than that, but the idea was to get the key parties who have very much live issues across the site visit. If there's anyone else that you'd suggest that we direct that to, we're happy to broadcast it more widely.
We'll think about that overnight. I know one off the top of my head. I mean, we want the lie of the land rather than particular going to particular submitters who have an issue on their land.
Okay. So I've asked for feedback on that overnight. We should be able to present you with something that looks like a consolidated draft agenda for you to then think about.
Right. Much appreciated for
and
that.
And I think arrangements are in place for vehicles, and I think it's all lined up for tomorrow afternoon after we conclude.
Excellent, thank you. Hopefully at least one of those spots is interesting.
It was a very impressive half bridge.
Oh, yes. As long as we approach it from the right side. Right. All right, well, with that, I think we're adjourned. So thank you very much, everybody, and we'll resume tomorrow at 9 o'clock.